welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show at the Hot Stove Society. Here we are once again. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotier, chef in a hat.
And I'm KDO.
And you're KDO, and I am the owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, catering company, cooking school right here at the Hot Stove. We do lots of things here in Seattle. And this week, we are opening in partnership with Nordstrom over in Bell Square. It's a very exciting time.
Bento Box.
Officially Monday the 18th is the opening.
So. Oh, my gosh. I can't wait. You know how much I love to shop and eat at Nordstrom at the same time.
There you go. You will not be able to get, in Bellevue anyway, the onion rings and the martini at the same time.
Oh, that's okay. Can I still get the martini, though? Because that's what really motivates the retail therapy
afterwards. You know, shopping with martini has got to be the most dangerous thing in the world.
Or the most joyful thing that you can do.
Yeah, well, you'll be able to get an Aperol sake slushy.
What? Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. I'm there.
Just saying. Anyway, it's the first of our partnerships with Nordstrom. They own and operate. We don't own the restaurant at all, but we're simply working with them, consulting and having a good time. And when I've been over there all week and did lots of testing and eating and adjustments, and it's going to be really fun.
What's your favorite little bento taste that you're doing over there?
You know, it's called the bento department, so you can adjust your taste, whatever your is. But we're serving wild Bristol Bay salmon, which is always delicious.
Oh, yeah.
The little one of my favorite tastes that we make in our company is our coconut curried chicken at the Tanaka-san for the bento box. And we've transferred that over to that department, too. So I like the coconut curried chicken. And, you know, there's just a lot of great taste. Mm-hmm. They're even doing coconut cream pie pudding.
Really?
Yeah, we have little to-go containers of... So Tom, all the filling and then the topping, but not the crust.
So, Tom, let me understand this. In the bento box, you get hot item and cold item, or just cold item?
Yeah, okay. But it's, both. I don't know, seven or eight different things. Lots of pickles and those sorts of things. Anyway, I'm just excited about it, as you can tell. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to that. Also on today's show, our favorite taste of the week, and I'll talk about the bento there for a second. Lexi Ochoa comes by. She's the chef here at the Hot Stove Society, and we're having an event to raise money to put beehives in schools that want them, right?
Yeah.
There's 250 schools on the waiting list, so we're calling it the pollinator event here at the Hot Stove.
Do you know how much is a beehive?
I don't know, but I'm sure Lexi could tell us.
Yeah, that's cool.
Maybe. We have Cuban food expert Imogene Tondra is going to be here with her new book, Cuba, a Cookbook. And, of course, we have the... Food for Thought, tasty trivia, as we do every week to wrap up our two-hour show. So if you leave early, you are missing a bunch.
Yeah.
The most interactive part of the show, where you get to yell at us the correct answers while we potentially get them wrong.
People tell me they're in their car, stuck in traffic on the highway, and they're yelling at their radio, like, hey, you knucklehead, it's this or it's that.
It's brazing. Yeah.
And I think knucklehead was a nice term.
Yeah, probably. Censored for radio.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So first, let's jump into... Ordinary. Oh, and I should say, because it's on the tip of the tongue, we're going to have Food in the News, and we'll talk about Anthony Bourdain in our Food in the News segment in the second hour. So,
most definitely.
He is certainly in the news. Ordinary to extraordinary.
Ordinary to extraordinary. This is where you take some ordinary dishes and you make them extraordinary. And what we've been doing is looking at the national celebratory calendar for all the foods, which there is one for every single day of the week, it seems. But... let's start with one that's just because I'm assuming, is this Tina or Sarah that likes, Sarah, our production assistant, really has a thing for gazpacho.
Really?
So she would like to know, as we head into tomato season, you know, it's almost
jumping
here.
Jumping the gun a little bit.
I know, I realize, that's why I'm saying it's almost here, but we're getting excited for it.
Okay.
We need to help Sarah make an extraordinary gazpacho.
Well, first of all, we should know how she actually makes her own, because... What are you used to in terms of gazpacho? Because there's a few different versions out there.
I thought it was a traditional recipe, you know, just with bread and tomatoes and garlic, the normal things, and you blend them all together. It's just like the easiest of summer foods in my mind. It's
cold.
Do you
like crunchy gazpacho? I mean, pieces of vegetable, or do you like just puree the whole thing?
Usually I puree the whole thing, but I am open to changes.
I like chunky.
Well, let's start with the number one thing you said, which was bread.
Yeah.
I don't put bread in my
gazpacho.
Yeah,
there's no bread in gazpacho.
So I don't. Well, there might be. Who knows?
Yeah.
So the recipe you're reading has bread, right?
Yeah, it was from the How to Cook Everything by Mark Bittman.
Mark Bittman, right there. So
there you go.
Mark Bittman says put bread in it. Who's going to argue with him?
I'm not.
Anyway, so you tell us, because that's an interesting thing. Yeah. Is the bread there just to give it some body and soak up some of the juices of the peppers and the
cucumbers? I suppose so. It also gets blended together, mm-hmm. so it creates kind of, a little bit of a different texture. It's not quite as watery as mm-hmm. I assume it is right. without it.
Correct. Well, here's what I would say about gazpacho right now for me. And, Terry, I think you're probably in the same boat. But this time of year, it's strawberry time or it's cherry time in our location. Right. So I would move the gazpacho to more of a dessert, like a strawberry gazpacho or a strawberry gazpacho soup with savory. So maybe you have some preserved or Mama Lil's peppers or something where you take that nice sweet strawberry and you balance it out with some peppers of the goat horn peppers of a little spicier variety and puree those two things together. Just straight strawberries is going to be too sweet for a savory beginning. So you can either take it into dessert or start with something of that sort.
That's incredibly interesting sounding. Thank
you. I would also do, we do a cherry gazpacho, Bing cherry gazpacho at Luke every year. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice. You put a little red wine vinegar and, sherry vinegar and cherry wine mixed together, sweated some onions, add all the sherry wine, the sherry vinegar, put all the cherries in there. Blend the whole thing up, and then that is a pureed gazpacho. And then what you can do is on the side, you take some cherries and macerate them, cut them in small pieces and macerate them with just a little bit of sea salt and cracked pepper, and then use that as a garnish with maybe a little goat cheese or something, and you have a wonderful gazpacho mm-hmm. of cherry.
Well, those both sound wonderful. Thank you. I will report back after
I try. Yeah, and both of those will be good with, say, grilled bread on the side or something of that
nature. But to finish your gazpacho in the summertime, I would say we'll get back to it when summer is here and we actually have those tomatoes in season.
All right, really quick. What about chocolate eclairs? Let's get prepared for June 22nd, Chocolate Eclair Day. That seems like one I want to celebrate.
Well, here's the thing. I think you can make eclairs very seasonal, right? Mm-hmm. So I think chocolate we've had all summer, all winter long. Now's the time to make a strawberry custard, right? Or a cherry custard or something of that nature. Not even lemon this time of year, right? We had that all winter.
Yeah.
Get out that fresh fruit and do it anywhere where you can substitute that for a wintry
version. So a general éclair is pâte à choux, which is a dried dough, a baking dough that will dry up a little bit. And I recommend, if depends on what you're going to put on top of your éclair, to make the dough the day before, bake the day before, so overnight it dries out a little bit, so your dough becomes a little bit crusty.
Mm-hmm.
So, because if you're going to be putting a topping on top of that, like a sweet cream or whatever you're going to do.
Glaze.
Yeah, glaze and sweet cream. And it's going to get soggy. So you want to make sure that it's dried up a little bit. But just put pastry cream, a little whipped cream with it, so Parisian cream, with a bunch of fruits diced in there. It's delicious.
Yum. Sounds great.
Up next, we're going to do a little cooking at Katie's house for a group of friends. But this time we're going to use cherries in every course on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back at the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. We're here every week, every Saturday and Sunday, sometimes three times a weekend now. Three different shows where you can always podcast us.
That's right, at your convenience.
Right, and if you want to come be part of our studio audience and have a delicious Dahlia Bakery sandwich with your hot coffee.
Endless coffee.
And all you got to do is go to hotstovesociety.com, look for the Seattle Kitchen Show. It will set you back $15.
And however long it takes you to get here, but it's worth it. Yeah. It's worth it, I'd say.
The journey is well thought of amongst the people that actually show up.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Tom, it's time to have dinner party. Terry,
yes,
you're
I'm
invited
ready.
As well. As I like to do, I invite you to come and cook. that's the role you're going to play.
It's a nice role you have.
Well, I pour you guys the cocktails. That's what I do, is I welcome you with a beverage. But what you're going to do is use a single ingredient in every single course, and today it's going to be cherries. Cherries. And
love cherries.
Mm-hmm. And as we like to do, we're going to invite a special guest. Tom, who's our guest going to be?
And now, from stage left, George Washington.
Yay!
Yay!
Good job cutting down that tree, Georgie.
My big thing is I want to know, he is famous for his wooden dentures. And I just want to know how he gets the cherry stains out of his wooden dentures.
Maybe he doesn't.
Maybe he doesn't.
Let's serve him some red wine tonight, too.
Can you imagine the... I would think that his the air from his face would not be the most pleasant.
Little
I don't want to say that our first president had bad breath, but can you imagine?
Yeah, it seems like it'd
I think
be
you can
funky.
Say that. It's probably a sure thing.
Okay. All right.
Maybe it would just smell like a dock or something like that, you know, nice and woodsy and wet. Is that taking it too far?
That might have gone a little far.
maybe we'll edit that out of the show.
You forgot to mention at low tide.
At low tide.
And
exactly.
With all the duck poop on it.
All right. So let's start this dinner party. Who would like to take the appetizer and cocktail?
I'll start with the cocktail. I'm going to make a little sangria of cherry. Because I think bean cherries, are when they're perfectly ripe, is delicious. Pit them out. Cut them in pieces. Do a little red wine. Do a little oranges. Add to that bay leaf, a little, maybe a little coriander toasted. Put that in there and let it macerate overnight. A little sugar, obviously. And then serve that as a welcome with a big bunch of ice. Because George doesn't know about ice, obviously. He didn't use
to. Well, he crossed the Delaware. There was plenty of ice.
Yes.
He probably wasn't putting it in his wine.
I don't think they brought that for his ice cube and his whiskey.
When you're making sangria, Chef, what kind of wine are you looking for?
Usually I like to use a nice Ribera del Duero, a nice Spanish red, okay. A nice, something that has quite a good fruit in it. Like Gamay is very good for that.
Mm-hmm.
A grape that has a lot of fruit in it, yeah.
Yeah.
Not a, don't use, a, I mean, I'm not trying to look for like a Cabernet or anything like
that. Like a really
I'm not looking for that.
Wine.
I'm looking for something that has lightness and robust fruit in it. So. And then you macerate. When you make a real sangria, when I make a whole, the true sangria of just orange, lemon, from the real Spanish recipe, usually I macerate for at least 4 or 5 days in the basement. And I let that macerate really well, and then I strain the whole thing and put fresh fruit in it the day of.
Mmm, interesting.
Sounds
okay,
good.
Yeah. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Tom.
George has got a smile on his face.
He's a little drunk already.
Yeah, he's a little drunk already.
He's a little drunk. He came back from the grave to get a little drunk.
So I'm going to do a little something. I take off of what I made for dinner the other night, but with cherries.
Mm-hmm.
I just took one of those live heads of greens that they sell to Whole Foods, and it's got oak leaf, a little endive, a little red leaf, a little green leaf, and it's all in the same bundle. It's like they seeded them all together.
Oh, interesting.
And so I cut the little root ball off of it. It's live.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put them, the base into water, and it's just the whole thing blossomed up like a big tulip or a flower, you know? It was very beautiful. Got very firm. And I put a little bowl of goat cheese and a little bowl of the peppernata from last season's Prosser Farm peppers that I had made and keep in the freezer.
Such a good pantry you have.
No. Well, it is a good pantry.
Yeah.
But I'm going to put cherries in my peppernata.
Delicious.
I alluded to that earlier with the gazpacho with strawberries and the
right.
peppers. I
right.
think
mm-hmm.
it's a nice combination. And so, and then I did it with a little bits of baguette toast, or you can take the leaves and make little sandwiches out of the leaves with the cherry peppernata and the goat cheese.
Well, look at you. How healthful.
Yeah.
It's very nice. Very light little appetizer.
I'm a healthful
there.
Guy. Look at me.
Look at you. The picture of
this
health.
This is where I was thinking about coming to
for those that can't see through podcast or the radio airwaves, there's been sleeve rolling up and some muscle flexing. All right, Thierry.
Well, knowing George has good denture and he's got good mouth to chew with.
Yeah, sure.
I think I'm going to do a little leg of lamb on the barbecue on the grill, you know, on the barbecue. Just simply macerated olive oil, salt, pepper, maybe a little spice, you know, a little chili pepper on top of that. And then grill that medium rare to medium. Let it sit. Slice it very thin. And then do a Rainier cherry salad. So I do Rainier cherry, a little bit of sherry vinegar and white vinegar, olive oil, lots of olive oil. I'm big into the olive oil into this recipe, I guess. Olive oil, lots of fresh herb. Mix that all together and then put that on top of your sliced lamb. I think he's going to be a happy cowboy there.
I would think so.
Delicious.
If that doesn't pull out his dentures, nothing will.
George, we just want you to change the denture.
Well, speaking of which, is there any trick to creating a tender leg of lamb on the grill?
Yes, I think if you cook it medium rare to medium, a leg of lamb should not be rare.
Mm-hmm.
You should cook it medium rare to medium, let it sit, slice it very, very thin as you can slice it, because the thinner you slice it, the less chances you have to have those muscles and fiber in between the slices. Mm. So you'll have pieces of meat that will be very easy to eat. And I prefer the leg of lamb to many parts of the lamb, as a matter of fact. It's one of the beautiful parts of the lamb.
And typically shank off, right? Because the shank is, you can't cook that even medium rare. That needs to be well done because it's got so much tenderness.
I'm talking about the thigh part of the leg.
But even if you get a shoulder of lamb and take the blade out and then tie it back up again, makes it perfectly tender. Oh. But I think Terry is correct. The real tenderizing is the slicing.
Is the slicing.
Thin against the grain.
Yeah, that is the real key there.
That's the key.
Okay.
How to keep grandma happy.
Or George.
My mom loves a good leg of lamb.
Does she?
And I love it, too. She made it all of our lives.
Uh-huh.
But I like it well cooked.
Yeah, I like
that Greek style where
medium.
You just kind of fall off the bone.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's
for dessert, we're going to, you know, George routed the Hessians, I believe, at Valley Forge? No, what was the town they were in when he crossed the Delaware? He routed the Germans who were asleep and drunk at the time.
What town?
And that's what turned the tide of the Revolutionary War. So anyway, so we're going to have, in their honor of the Hessians, we're going to have Black Forest cake. Don't you think?
Yeah, perfect.
A beautiful cake. We're going to macerate the cherries in a little Kirschwasser and some Merlot. So I don't want it to be too sweet, too alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to make the chocolate shavings around the outside and a big chocolate cake with kind of a whipped cream frosting in, amongst the layers, all finished up with cherries on top.
And then a little side of schnapp.
Well, cherry schnapp would be fine. Yeah. Like a Kirschwasser is more like a cherry schnapp.
That is a delicious-sounding cake. And, you know, one of those that we talk about this all the time, where things kind of fall in and out of fashion in terms of food. And a Black Forest cake, I have not seen one of those in quite some time.
Long time.
You're really bringing it back.
I think it's one of those cakes that kind of got a little bit bastardized in terms of it fell off and became kind of not so great for a while.
And then ended up on every Denny's menu. And it just was one of those things.
And then now it's time to bring it back as a real Black Forest cake, because a real Black Forest cake is delicious.
All right, Imogene Tondra is going to be here on the phone, which we don't do very often. Her book, Cuba, the Cookbook, by Faden Publishing, is going to be released now, I believe, or soon. I believe she's also coming here to the Hot Stove on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. Yay! It's Katie O, the chef in the chapeau, and Tom Douglas at your service. We have Imogene Tondra here. She's written a book with Madeline Vasquez Galvez called Cuba, the Cookbook. She was in town last week. We missed her before she got on out of town, but we got her on the line here. Welcome to the show, Imogene.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
A tome. I mean, this book is much more than a cookbook. It's a tome. This is a historic novel, it seems like. What's your background in Cuban cooking? What turned you on so much about it that you wrote this, that this book was important to you?
Well, I moved to Cuba in 2010, and right away, it was really interesting for me to see how much people talked about food. People were constantly asking me, oh, but do you know how to cook Cuban food? And if I said, oh, I'm learning, people were very generous offering recipes and telling me exactly how a certain dish should be prepared. When I would go out to the farmers markets, people are always talking about produce, whether it's a good selection or, you know, too ripe or not ripe enough and where you can get the best deals. So there was just this constant conversation going on from the very first days that I lived in Havana. And then in 2011, I was involved with a project to bring a delegation of chefs from the Bay Area down to Havana and have a kind of a culinary exchange. And these chefs put on workshops and created menus and meals with Cuban chefs. And it was really a specifically ideal moment because the private restaurant sector has grown dramatically since around that time, starting in about 2010-2011. The licenses for private restaurants, many more licenses were given to Cubans opening these businesses. So the food scene has shifted dramatically since that time. And it was really interesting to be involved in this particular delegation because the chefs, who were mostly from the Berkeley restaurant Chez Panisse, they had either worked there at the time or had been trained there at one point and moved on to other restaurants. They have a certain philosophy of just finding the freshest produce and creating a meal from the best ingredients, and that is very relevant to the Cuban reality, where you go to a market and you might not have a wide selection, you might not have very much variety, so you have to work with what you have. So that was in 2011, and then after that I did a master's at the University of Havana, and my thesis was studying the private sector and food culture. And through the delegation I mentioned, I met Madeleine Vasquez, who has been working with, she's done all kinds of work. She's published many cookbooks. She was one of the founding members of the first vegetarian restaurant in Havana, or in all of Cuba, actually. And she has a cooking show. So she and I became colleagues and friends, and then she also helped me when I was working on my thesis. And then Fiden commissioned the two of us to write this book together.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I like the fact that Cuba has been colonized by many different countries, different cultures. It must be a very interesting thing to research and to actually cook from, right?
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things that we mentioned in the introduction, that Cuba has actually been more influenced, or Cuban cuisine specifically, has been more influenced by the island's history and the migrations than its geography. When you think about how the Spanish basically eradicated the indigenous population, there are still some dishes and ingredients that come from the natives of Cuba, but for the most part they were wiped out. Now that means that the diet that's being created is based on Spanish preferences, and they imported livestock and pork, you know, those imports then replaced some of the fishing and use of other natural resources on the island. People always ask, why isn't there more fish here? It's an island. and there are lots of reasons for that, but one of them dates back to the preferences that were really kind of forced onto the people because they were from the colonizers. And then later, when the United States was very present on the island between 1898 and 1959, there was some more influences from the U.S. Later, after the revolution, there was influences from the Soviet Union, which, you know, think about the distance and the cultural differences, but there was these political ties that meant that there were also products and ingredients from the Soviet Union on the Cuban market. So yeah, I mean, and of course there were other ways of influence from French and Haitian and Jamaican, and so you see that, and we talk about that in the introduction and in some of the recipes.
So Imogene, what's the backbone of Cuban cuisine? I mean, your book has, it must, I mean, it's so thick, it must have 300, 400, 500 recipes in it. Is there a backbone? Is there a flavor base? Is there a food base? I mean, so much of Central America is still based on rice and beans. You know, I can imagine there'd be tropical fruits, but and certainly fish. But is there a flavor backbone of Cuban cuisine?
In terms of the flavors that you find in everything, from bean stews to meat, garlic, onion, bell pepper, tomato, cumin. Those are very bay leaf, oregano. Those are very important. Both the sofrito, which is basically just like this stir fry of the garlic, onion, and bell peppers, then you add tomato sauce. That gets put in everything, whether it's you make it separately and add it to your bean soups, you put it over meat. So those are kind of the most typical ingredients that you find in everybody's kitchen, no matter what.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I noticed when I was in Miami, and, you know, of course, when you're in Miami, that's the closest I've been to Cuba, personally. And you're always looking for a Cuban restaurant. You always hear about Little Havana and places like that. American Cuban restaurants, is it a pretty literal translation? Or, like, when you said you brought chefs from Berkeley to Cuba, my concern is that, you know, us chefs, we always like to do our own thing with the food. It's not necessarily a literal translation of what's happening in Cuba. And so do you feel like the Cuban restaurants in the States are...
only the ingredients that you could find on the island. Sure, they had some adaptations that maybe weren't... you know, it's not traditional Cuban food. It's American chefs who have this interpretation of using Cuban ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, it wasn't, you know, the most traditional Cuban dishes. In terms of Cuban restaurants in the States, I honestly don't know because I've been living in Cuba, so okay. I can't really answer that. But if there are, I've gone to a few restaurants here and there that seem kind of like fusion, like this vague, you know, Caribbean or Central American, you know, mixed all together. Just the other day in Seattle, I went to a place that had Cuban sandwiches that tasted pretty authentic, but then there were other dishes that were from other countries. So, you know, that's that particular place. I think it's also normal, you know, in like with Mexican food, people talk about the burrito as like this authentic Mexican dish, and it's Mexican American. There are examples of that. The Cuban sandwich is not common in Cuba, and we talk about it in the book, kind of where its origin, where it came, where it was, and it was in Tampa, Florida. Most people think there's some discrepancy, but most people think that it came.
Well,
we have all sorts of things like that. Even teriyaki here in Seattle is thought of very similarly as maybe from Japan, but actually it's just a construct that happened here in the Pacific Northwest. I will say, being so far away from Cuba, up here in our little corner of the United States, it's incredibly exciting to have a book like yours available on the shelves right now so that all of us can have a little bit of a taste of Cuban cuisine.
I also will say that Imogene was just here in Seattle, both at Elliott Bay, Third Place Books, the book larder, and I'm sure there's signed copies of this Cuba the Cookbook available still at those stores. Did you love Seattle when you were here, Imogene?
I did. It wasn't the first time I'd been there, but it was the first time I'd been in the summertime, and it was gorgeous. So I had a great time.
Well, I would suggest anyone who's interested in this cuisine, it's a tome. You got to be committed. I'm not sure what recipe I want to start with, but there's so many to choose from. It's a beautiful book. It's called Cuba the Cookbook. Imogene's been our guest here, Fiden Publishing. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Buenos días.
Buenos días. Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye-bye. It's interesting. Congratulations, you two, for getting her on the air. That's we've been struggling with that through our history of the Seattle Kitchen Show. When we've gone off-site from the studio, from the Cairo studio. So next up, pro tips on how to handle your veggies on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're back here at the Hot Stove Society. Our audience is desperately waiting their breakfast sandwich from the Dahlia Bakery.
You famished.
Too. Yeah, they're famished. Mm-hmm. As am I.
As am I.
As am I.
Yes.
All right. Veggie pro tips. Katie, you want to lead us down the path?
I certainly do.
How, what, why, all of the above.
I think actually you're going to tell us how, what, and why. However, as we like to do, we like to call the internet for some hot tips, and then we turn to you to see if they're actually true or should we debunk them. But this one is all about pro tips for vegetables. So the first tip that we've got here is buy from the source. All right. So the source being the farmer's market, direct from the farmer. What do you feel about this? This time of year, farmer's markets are very busy.
If you've got the time and the money, you should definitely buy from the farmer's market.
Which I think is a big part of it,
quite frankly.
The money is no joke at these places.
And the time.
And the time.
Yeah, because it takes, I mean, to stroll through a market is one of the most beautiful, romantic thing to do. But
And it's free.
To roam through it is free. You know, you haven't spent any money, but it is definitely takes time, and to buy takes money because farmers need to be supplied just like anybody else. And you know, it's easy to spend $100 at a farmer's market. Let me put it this way.
Yeah, that's one chicken at one stand that I went to. I mean, literally, the duck was $90.
Where was I? I don't remember what city I was in the state. Once I went to the farmer's market, I remember we were on vacation, and I bought a rack of lamb, and it was $120 from a farmer, because he was like, "Oh, this is from a farm," and I was like, "Oh, I'll take the rack of lamb, no problem."
Uh-huh.
And when he said $120, I almost choked. I was like, Whoa.
But this, I mean,
you know, you used to back rack and flam in restaurant business. You pay your wholesale, number one.
Yeah.
And it just kind of shocked me. It was like,
farmers are modernists these days. He probably could put you on a 12-month payment plan.
Yeah, no, of course.
through his Square checkout.
Of course.
His online checkout.
He probably pulled out his iPhone and went, do you have a credit card?
But this extends into fruit and vegetables as well. So if you're kind of accustomed to purchasing your produce from a more everyday average grocery store, the prices at a farmer's market are maybe going to really surprise you.
Which is why you have food deserts, right? You know,
right.
certain segments of society just can't afford to make that choice, and so you end up with them not getting this delicious, great food that you and I are lucky enough to be able to get.
Yeah,
so,
it's a fortunate thing.
It's a fortunate thing. So we've gone by that. We've decided we're all fortunate, right, for the moment. And so what are some tips that we need to know?
Think like a meat eater when you're cooking your vegetables. Mm-hmm. Now, what's your thought on that statement, just right off the bat?
Think like a meat eater when you're... are you thinking like medium rare rare? Are you thinking
I think what they're trying to say is think like a meat eater is when you take a turnip and you mix it with some wild mushroom, you had a level of flavor that now is going to start to be like more like a meat, which is more like richer and denser and in terms of flavor. To me, I think that's not necessarily something you should do every single time you cook vegetable. There is some vegetable that are very delicious to eat on their own, and there are some vegetables that do need a little help.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think there's maybe the concept too, which I think the Carlisle Room does a nice job of, which is essentially, you know, a lot of people feel like, especially if you're omnivorous and you eat meat, that the meat is really the main star of the dish.
Right.
You know, there's kind of that concept of Sunday dinners where it's like meat and two vegetable sides. In this particular case, I think what they're trying to say is that vegetable is really the star of the dish. It takes center stage, and maybe you have some accent protein on the side, but that's what you're thinking of there.
Which I think you can do, but it's often, I think certain vegetables get relegated to that role that and others get forgotten about. Like a daikon radish can easily be the star of the dish, right? If it's a slow braise, it's a big chunk, as can an artichoke. It's harder to think of ways, say, on zucchini, and that's why all these zucchini noodles are become
zoodles,
right? Now the zucchini's the star of the dish. Straight up, it's hard to think about like broccoli being the star of the dish. It's more of a broccoli beef is right. You know,
I think that's what they're trying to say is if you take, for example, broccoli, you put them in the oven, you roast them at 500 degrees until they're nice and crispy, and then on the side you saute some beautiful mushroom to go back to the mushroom story. Now you've created a flavor that is very much more intense than just eating a steamed vegetable. And that's, I think, what they mean by creating think meat in terms of profile.
Well, actually, that plays really nice into the next tip, which is play with your food. And it's really thinking about vegetables. Can it be raw, roasted, grilled, poached, pickled, all these different things? And can you use maybe potentially some of the things that we think of just tossing away with those vegetables?
Yes.
Yes.
What do you mean? So like the stalk and all that?
Yeah, exactly. Like, so for example, a lot of us buy cauliflower, for example, and we're going to roast that cauliflower perhaps, and we discard all those outer leaves. But those outer leaves are perfectly edible. Celery leaves, another really delicious thing to add into your salads. But a lot of people just chop them off and throw them away. So what do you think about this? Do you employ it in your own cooking?
I think it works in certain areas. Like the cauliflower one's a good example. It caramelizes up all those leaves and the stem caramelize up and become tender. But the whole thing, like with roasted carrots and then making carrot top pesto, it just doesn't taste good to me. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I know that's not a hipster thing to say, but carrot top pesto, unless you put some basil and something else into
it. Fortify it. That's another
flavors. Just not that good.
Young carrot top can taste, you know, if you mix it into a salad, it's just one of the greens that you have in your salad.
I mean, right, so that's a little different, right?
Let's talk about
the star of the show.
Correct.
Let's talk about the tops of some vegetables, because you do have that option, even if you're just going to the grocery store, your PCCs and Met Markets and Whole Foods. Oftentimes, they will sell root vegetables with the top still attached.
Yeah, like kohlrabi. I just recently bought a whole bunch of kohlrabi and did all the greens separately. It was delicious. It's a little bit harder to cook. You know, you just have to be, you have to recognize the difference of thickness, the tenderness of each of the items. So the stem part of the leaves, you just separate from the top part of the leaf, and then you saute the leaf just one quick saute in a very hot stir fry pan, and then you have your tender leaves, and then the green, the stem part, you cook a little bit longer. You just cook in the pan a little bit slower because it's a much harder piece of vegetable. So you just have to keep that in consideration, just like you would a piece of meat. You know, you don't cook the chicken wing the same way that you cook the chicken, the whole chicken. You know, it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So you have to think of the thickness, the time it takes to cook, and what are you trying to achieve. I like to chew on things, but not too much.
What I wanted to get to before we only have a minute or so left is don't go for looks. And if you shop regularly at places, you might be able to figure out when the produce guys are actually turning over the produce for the day. And, you know, they go through and they pick everything off the shelf that doesn't look like it's going to make it a day or two. And I was at Shoreline Central Market the other day, and I needed some mangoes for a mango salsa I was doing for halibut. And I happened to be there, and the guy was changing out the mangoes, and he was pulling all these ultra-ripe mangoes off the shelf, putting them in a box. I said, what are you going to do with them? He says, well, they're too ripe. I said, those are exactly the ones I mm-hmm. want for my salsa.
And you get them for half price.
I got 15 mangoes for, I think, not even $10. And
what a steal.
They were perfect.
Yeah.
And I didn't need 15 mangoes, but I prepped them all. When I did it, I used half in my salsa. I prepped the other half in the chunks, IQF'd them individually, quick mm-hmm. froze them for my freezer. Now I have all this beautiful mango in my freezer.
And ripe
and
mango.
Ripe. And so do some smart shopping.
Yeah.
Don't always look for the prettiest. Look for the ripest.
Yeah.
Right? And if the farmer's market is too expensive for you, I would advise to go towards the end of the farmer's market. If it closes at 2, go at 1:30, 1:45, even 2 o'clock, and then go to the stall of the farmers and say, hey, do you have anything that's going bad you don't want to take back to the farm? I'll buy it half price.
I'll buy it right now. Up next, your favorite taste of the week on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Favorite taste of the week. We have food in the news, including our sad chat about Mr. Tony Bourdain. We've got Chef Lexi to talk bees from here at the Hot Stove Society. And, of course, our Food for Thought tasty trivia. But first, our taste of the week. One taste that you had, KDO, last week that knocked your socks off?
Knocked my socks off. So I'm very lucky, although a bit controversial because the Central District neighborhood is changing quite a bit. But the upshot of that is we're getting a lot of good food in the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And one of those things is actually Woodshop Barbecue. So they do a lot of different barbecue there. But one thing that I had, because I was like, maybe I'll go for something lighter, although seemingly impossible to do at a barbecue joint, they're smoked wings. They had these really delicious smoked wings. And the nice thing about them, what I love the most is the texture of the skin when they're smoked the way they are. They're almost like a snappy, crisp exterior skin. They're dry rubs, so they're incredibly flavorful, not to mention the smoke quality. And that was probably one of my favorite tastes of the week. It was very good.
I thought Woodshop was down on Yesler Way downtown.
No, Woodshop, they have a truck, so it kind of roams around a little bit, and people can, I believe, rent it for catering events and that sort of thing. But their brick and mortar is, I want to say, at about 25th in Jackson. But they've got a really nice little patio outside. Sometimes they have live music, delicious ribs, and that's it's a really great little neighborhood hangout.
I gotta check it out. Check out the wings.
Yes.
Any sauce to go with that?
They have all sorts of sauces. They make their own barbecue sauce, a hot one, a coffee one with the that they did as a collaboration with the coffee roaster, actually, just right next to our broadcast coffee company. But we like the spicy one. I like it a little hot.
A little heat.
Yeah. But I like to keep it on the side because then that way the wings still kind of maintain their crispy texture.
Okay. Chef, you got anything to add to that? Your favorite taste of the week?
I'm anxious to go try it because this is not too far from my hood. Yeah. So I'm definitely...
Come and meet me anytime.
I know. We 25th and Jackson.
We can have a little cocktail. We'll have wings. It'll be fun.
They have cocktails too?
Oh, yeah. They have a fun
bar. Definitely there.
Okay.
For me, I think test of the week would have to be... I was working on at Luc for like the last 4 days. And I think morels, which are in season right now, really, really... pumped me up the whole 4 days I was working. Made a wonderful little sauce of morel, and you can you know, write that down if you want to, or listen to the show again and podcast it and listen to the recipe. But you take butter. You start with butter because with butter, it's always better. And sweat some shallots, a little bit of chopped garlic, some fresh thyme chopped. You sweat that whole thing up. Then you throw in all your morel that have been either, if they're very, very, very small, you just keep them whole. Otherwise, you cut them in half and put them in there.
Mm-hmm.
Sauté the whole thing together. Deglaze with a couple shots of Armagnac. Then put in a little bit of demi-glace or veal stock. Reduce that down a little bit. Dash of cream, nugget of butter, and some little bit of fresh tarragon at the end. And this will be a sauce that you can keep in your refrigerator. I mean, you make a little, make a bigger batch, because when you buy morel, you buy obviously more than one meal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use that on chicken. You can use that in a risotto. Like if you, I was making a sampa risotto, which is a toasted barley, fermented toasted barley, and make that with vegetables and mushroom and morel. And that was delicious. You just throw that sauce right on top, and it really makes a very easy, quick thing. You could put that on pasta. You cook some pasta and put that sauce right on top. But morels this time of the year are just, you out to go buy some and treat yourself.
It really is a great time of the year. Like going to really any market at this point, and you see Washington strawberries, you see asparagus, still Washington asparagus.
Yeah.
You've got morels, you've got artichokes from probably Northern California, Southern California, wherever those are coming from.
Castro Valley.
It's a great time of year for produce. Yeah. Super exciting. Tom, what was your taste of the week?
Well, I'm going to piggyback on Terry a little bit because my taste of the week was twofold. One is that it builds my pantry. So when I was at that same time that I was at Shoreline Market, they had beautiful pile of Bilitis mushrooms right next to a gorgeous pile of morels. And so I bought both. And I keep a little real truffle butter in my freezer. I buy it at the Seattle Caviar. They have a little butter that I like there. It's not full of fake ingredients.
Right, it's real truffle
butter. It's real truffle butter. And so when I think about those mushrooms, when I see them like that, and in reality, they're super expensive, but for what they are, they were at one of the better price points that I've seen them. So perfect, completely no worm, Bilitis, small, perfect, right? They were $29 a pound, which is fairly cheap for perfect Bilitis.
Yeah, for perfect
100%
Bilitis.
Usable.
Mm-hmm.
And then the morels were perfect, dry, not over the edge, you know, in perfect shape. They were $19.99 a pound. So, yes, that's super expensive, but in the reality of, for those particular mushrooms, the quality and the value was there for me. So that's when I look at that and I say, okay, I'm putting some in my freezer. I'm stocking up my freezer right now. So I bought 3 pounds of each. Sauteed them in butter, got them to, you know, not very cooked, just kind of wilted, because when you put them in your freezer, you want them to be wilted or else they're just going to slime out and melt in your freezer. So sauteed in a lot of butter, finished with a little bit of truffle butter to back up the mushroom flavor, and now I had this I put them in Ziplocs at about maybe a cup in a Ziploc.
Yeah.
Because if you're making a pot roast, if you're making anything, a soup, you just drop one of these little things into your soup, and you have this incredible layer of flavor that is beautiful. I still have chanterelles from last summer, the summer chanterelles.
Right.
I did the same thing with. Anyway, I was walking around, and then I saw lamb shanks, which I haven't bought in a very long time. So even though I just put these mushrooms in the freezer 2 days before to build my pantry, I pulled out a big pack of mushrooms, braised my lamb shanks, and then for the last 30 minutes put the mushrooms in along with my vegetables.
Right.
Made a real springy lamb shank, almost like a springtime stew,
right?
And I used a delicious, lightly sweet German Riesling instead of maybe a red wine or a heavier thing I might use in the wintertime. So there's like light Riesling, lamb, spring stew.
Lots of fresh herbs.
With lots of fresh herbs and those mushrooms. And I think it was a little bit of a lesson to myself sometimes, where you forget, like, God, if you build your pantry, you are going to be a better cook
day long. And if you don't have a big freezer, drying them up is also a great idea if you buy a dryer and put those sliced porcini and morel.
Up next, it's Food in the News on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. As we've been saying all morning long, you know, when we do our Food in the News segment here today, it was going to include Anthony Bourdain and our comments about that. Chef, do you have any thoughts about what happened this last week? I know when I go online, it's still very much in the headlines, even 10 days later. So
yeah, I was extremely busy over the weekend, and it was very hard to chase. And in the middle of brunch on Sunday, we got creamed. You know how that goes sometimes. And I was on the line, and I said, all right, guys, this one is for Bourdain. Mm-hmm. Because we were getting buried, and I said, okay, guys, let's do it. And, you know, overall, the thought is just pain. You know, it's like it's painful to hear something like this happening. And it's painful mainly because you don't realize that somebody who's giving so much, you know, has pain like that. You know, obviously, you know, he must have been in some pain that we don't know about.
Yeah.
And it's very, very sad. And, you know, you just wish you could have done something about it or know something about it so you could try to help. But obviously, it's too late. So,
yeah. KDO?
Oh,
I think of you, like,
yeah.
I think of Tony. I'm 60 this year. Mm-hmm. You're 35.
Yeah.
I think of Tony being maybe not your Julia Child, but certainly kind of a food image like Jacques Pepin or from Thierry's and my
Julia.
Julia and yeah. Jacques are very much ours. I think of him being your era, as even though he's much older than you.
Yeah, yeah. I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I was very sad about mm-hmm. this news, and we've certainly had a lot of celebrity deaths within the last couple of years that have been very public and notable. I think this one really affected me the most. When I think about, you know, his role personally in my life, he was a fixture of my household, mm-hmm. frankly. So when I was cooking dinner, for example, I would put on his show in the background, even episodes that I'd seen plenty of times. And so in a lot of ways, he was very much a part of my life. Even a lot of my travels were based upon places that I would have otherwise never seen before if mm-hmm. it weren't for his show.
No, many.
Many. And my conversations with people around my same demographic and age and who are within our industry have really been dominated by this particular death because it hits so close to home, because so many people really shaped some of their careers based off of his first book, Kitchen Confidential. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, you have what is a real mental health crisis mm-hmm. in our society, and I would say even especially within our industry, you know. So even though you can see someone and they seem to have what seems like the perfect life, right? He gets to travel everywhere. He gets to eat whatever he wants, the most delicious things. Seemingly through social media, he was having this great love affair with a beautiful Italian director and actress. He was part of the Me Too movement. He was just so very much...
Lovely daughter,
an 11-year-old daughter. So just a part of what I think of, if you love food, your social consciousness in a lot of ways. So to see him pass and to go the way that he did is really eye-opening mm-hmm. and a wake-up call, I think, for a lot of us.
I was stunned. You know, he's certainly, Terry and I have met him many times. We've done TV together. We've hung out and had dinner together, things like that. But I was more amazed at the how it affected our teams at the restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There were youngsters throughout our restaurant group absolutely in tears. Some had to go home. But it really affected them in a way that I guess I was a little unsuspecting of it. I knew people were going to be upset, but it didn't quite get the feeling that, or the intensity that it actually turned out to be.
Tom, the eulogy you wrote was absolutely beautiful.
Well, I was going to read it because for me, it's a place where my head went. I had to write a long note to my team because I had some very upset team members. But
right.
This, to me, was a little bit more succinct. And in a funny way, it's gone a little bit viral. It's kind of funny. The New York Times picked up my little... when I got to work that day, I had 8 requests from the media, 4 live, which I declined, and then mm-hmm. 4 also either like Seattle Magazine website or King TV or, you know, for online, Cairo Radio, you know, places like that. So I didn't... It almost felt like I was celebrating my friendship. Oh, yeah, I knew him, blah, blah, blah. It didn't feel right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I sat by myself and wrote a little, what I consider more of an ode to Tony. And so I'll read it to you. I will miss Tony's virtuosity, slaying dragons with a smirk, a sentence, or a meal. A wit to withstand thrown tomatoes, but a mind tortured to death by despair. Tony spoke the truth, disarming and sharp in real time, and even deeper cuts revealed upon ponder. Love for small thoughts with giant hearts. I am like age of Tony, brought to tears by the tears of my young team at wit's end, struggling to understand why their hero is so human. R.I.P. my friend Tom. And when I think of Tony, I think of the prose that he used to speak in. I love his voiceovers on his show. That's what kind of got me the most, more so than, I mean, I love the, you know, bringing the simplest dish and making a political statement out of the heritage of a country and politics. That's what he was best at. But his prose were so organic and human. Nothing polished in a funny way with big words, and but God, they were strong.
Right. Lots of similarity with Tom Douglas.
And I think that that's part of why it's affecting people so much is that yes, we all had a common love of food and food cultures, but he had a level of curiosity and humanity, and that's what we're all really missing at that point. At this point in time, is what he was bringing on just that human level.
Yeah, exactly. We all know, and I've been seeing this on TV a lot, so I'm glad Sarah put this in here for the suicide hotline number. That number is 1-800-273-8255. Or text CONNECT to 741-741. If you're feeling some of these dark thoughts, and that's kind of what I said to my team, you know, it's one thing to watch this happen to this kind of superstar and celebrity and... But what scares me the most is that somebody in my group is having these same dark clouds in their life, and they don't even realize it. Like you're sitting across the table, they're coming in for work, you're jousting, you're doing verbal gymnastics with them, right? You're doing all this stuff, and there's this cloud that you don't have a clue about because either they're good at hiding it or it's something that it's a cloud that I don't understand.
Well, right. And I would say, too, in so many industries, and this one included, I am assuming, is that there's a lot of pride in being strong, and there's a lot of shame in showing a level of weakness, and it's hard to ask for help in that construct.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And I'll finish. We don't have much time, but I will say Saturday night I had a waiter go down at Cuoco of a heart attack. Right when he was picking up food for one of his tables at the restaurant. And, you know, we went through four rounds of EMT, CPR, flatlined three times. We had already started CPR on him before the EMTs even got there. And the last one, when they were just about ready to give up, they got this faint pulse. And that was 2 days ago. Today's Tuesday. So that was 3 days ago now, two and a half. Mm-hmm. Got him to the hospital and sat in the emergency room at Harborview waiting for news. We thought he was dead. You know, we had to clear in a full restaurant. We had to clear the entire dining room. He broke every rib in his body, giving him CPR. And I saw him yesterday, and the nurse, I thought he was brain dead, honestly. He's down for 12 minutes. The nurse yelled his name, "Mark, you got a visitor," and his eyes opened, and he looked over at me. I said, "Wink if you know who I am." And he just closed his eyes as hard as he could. No, he's hooked up to every machine. Every rib is broken. Right. Both lungs punctured. He is a wreck. And he winked at me, and it was like a beautiful day. Mm-hmm. But I guess the point I was going to make in all this is sitting for hours in Harborview emergency room and looking at the people that are so desperately trying to survive, who have nothing. Mark has nothing, right? Doesn't even have health insurance. And then you look at your heroes, like Anthony, who you perceive has everything. It was such a weird thing to go through that, both directions.
A juxtaposition of lives.
It was just a weird, weird combination. All right, on that happy note, RIP Anthony. We're going to check in with Lexi Ochoa. She's the chef here at the Hot Stove Society because we're doing a bee benefit. Why not? Be careful out there on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the house. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. And we have Lexia Ochoa here. She is the chef here at the Hot Stove Society. And we have a little bee benefit coming up.
We do.
We do. And I just want to ask one question. Do you know where bees go to the bathroom?
No.
At the bee pee station. Come on, are you kidding me?
Is this a pun that I don't get?
BP.
BP. Oh, I get it. Okay,
yeah. Before your time, there used to be gas stations in Seattle called BP gas stations.
Oh, British Petroleum.
That's where that came from.
But in this case.
Thank you so much. Anyway, we're going to talk about bees, and I know everyone's laughing silly right now in their homes and in their gardens because that was such a funny joke, but we have to move on. Get over yourself.
Yes. yes, Tom.
Lexi, tell us what's going on here at the Hot Stove.
So the Whole Kids Foundation, which is a nonprofit, a part of the Whole Foods brand, has launched a honeybee and pollinator campaign to raise awareness as to the importance of our beloved pollinators in gardens and agriculture as a whole. Mm-hmm. So the quintessential goal of this foundation and the bee pollinator campaign is to raise money to put hives in schools from an educational standpoint to encourage kids to be interested and curious, but also to kind of better manage that fear that sometimes is instilled in kids at a young age and automatically kids kill bees sort of thing. And bees are obviously very important to all of the food that we eat.
Bees are our friends.
Very much so.
Especially the pollinator types.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is way more interesting than in my elementary school class. Like, we had a pet rat, and I'm not really sure what that was to teach us.
It wasn't a pet. It was just because they couldn't get rid of it.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't know.
Was his name Fred?
No. So you have these classes, and what is the hope to teach them on top of just, you know, understanding
What bees do. So bees have a very dynamic sort of living situation. All of the bees in the hive are ladies, with the exception of a couple of drones that are really just around for procreation purposes, and they get kicked out in the fall because they're
Jerry and I know all about this.
Mouths to feed. But the cycle is literally just to create more bees. So the worker bees feed the queen, so the queen makes babies, and it goes just the cycle goes on and on and on. But it's a lot of observation. And kind of the dynamics within the hive and how everyone kind of works together. And you kind of start off at the bottom of the food chain and you kind of work your way up as you grow. You get each bee is kind of assigned different tasks as they age. But yeah, mostly from an educational observational standpoint as to how bees pollinate crops, why they are important to us, different gardening aspects that encourage bees to come pollinate your garden and your flowers.
And then you do honey testing, I take it?
I hope so.
Because that's a
that
good,
would be the best
that's
part.
A great thing, yeah.
Yeah,
so tell
definitely.
Me about the honey.
So a lot of
why is it that they make this product and we can steal it and they still live?
I know. Well, we don't steal all of it. We just steal
Never.
There's kind of that happy medium of food that we can food for the bees, but honey for us.
So they do eat it themselves.
Yeah. Oh, well, okay. they and it kind of goes through the feeding process of the larva in addition to their royal jelly diets.
Royal jelly.
Yeah, but the queen really gets the royal jelly. That's why she gets longer and larger.
Huh.
And the worker bees are the ones that decide which larva will become the queen bees. So they usually feed like 20 different larvae this royal jelly to create queens. And then the queens kind of battle it out to see who's going to take over the nest.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really, really crazy.
Violent. Scary.
But they're not, like, violent creatures. They're curious and docile, which is why they tend to kind of bury in nooks and crannies of clothes and, you know, whatnot. But only until you start to kind of get angry and swat, they kind of feed off of that energy and pheromones that we release, and then they kind of start to attack.
They're in survival mode.
If you are calm and whistle or sing or, you know, help calm yourself down, they will also remain calm.
Also, teach the kid the difference between a bee and a wasp, because
totally.
There's a huge difference,
there
and many
is.
People don't know the difference.
So true. Yeah,
they see anything that looks like a bee, and it's to them, it's like
exactly.
It's, you know,
and yellow jackets, I would say.
Yeah, which is
one
why
step
people
farther.
Kill them. I mean, they kill them because they don't know the difference, so
totally.
They don't pay attention.
Yeah.
And a honeybee, I think once it stings, it's a goner, right?
Yeah.
Compared to a yellow jacket or a wasp.
Yeah, so wasps, yellow jacket would still be kind of a wasp cousin, but they both bite. I think yellow jackets also sting, but their sting doesn't
kill
become
them.
Removed from its abdomen.
Oh. Right.
Like a bee's does.
Mm-hmm.
So there are nearly 250 schools that are waiting for one of these honeybee hive grants. So what is the event that's happening here at the Hot Stove Society?
So we are doing a fundraising dinner next Thursday, the 21st.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a delicious menu planned. The goal is to obviously raise funds, and we're donating a portion of those funds to this foundation. The Whole Foods, Whole Kids Foundation is doing these kind of little pop-up dinners throughout the U.S. And with prominent restaurateurs like Mr. Tom Douglas himself.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any idea how much a beehive costs?
So the lowest basic level within this program, I think, runs about $300 for basic equipment. And then the highest is about $1,500, and it just is different levels of involvement from, a master beekeeper that comes in and does kind of instructional classes. The hives might be larger. There's maybe more hands-on involved in the higher kind of spectrum of things.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
And then with the hives, do the schools then also support it with, a garden? Where do these bees go?
Totally. I think that is the goal, to mm-hmm. have kind of that overlap. But bees travel for miles and miles and miles around to gather and forage for different pollens and flowers and crops and stuff. So there is a way to kind of feed them over the winter time that isn't with flowers, but the goal is that they will kind of forage from surrounding plants.
So you say they travel for miles, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then when you go to the store and you look at the honey, or down at the market, you'll say it says orange blossom honey, it says blackberry honey.
Sure.
Is that all nonsense?
No, totally.
I mean, how do you know? They traveled for miles. But who's to say they didn't stop on a clover?
That's true, but I think it would be a percentage. So if it was orange blossom, maybe those hives are predominantly in an orange blossom or in an orange grove.
Uh-huh.
So most of that pollination, most of the foraging happens within those, few square miles, which is that
and you believe
acre.
It.
Totally. I mean, have you done honey tasting and been able to taste the differences?
No. I've done honey tasting, but rarely could I
tell you the
differences. This is orange blossom or this is blackberry or...
Even the hives themselves will kind of take on that smell of whatever they're foraging.
All right. See, I was a cynic about that, and you've now changed my ways. So if people want to get involved, I know our event is sold out. If people want to get involved, what can they do? Is there a Wholesome website? Wholesome Kids?
Yeah. It's still part of Whole Foods. However, they have their own kind of subset that gives kind of overviews of everything. And I believe that you can donate online.
Good.
Yeah.
Because, I want to donate something for the kids.
Totally.
Yeah. I know at our farm, Prosser Farm, we just had our first zinnia blossom yesterday.
That's exciting.
Which is what Jackie plants to attract bees to pollinate her gardens.
Yeah.
Rows and rows of zinnias.
Yeah, that's good.
Do we have bees at Prosser?
We don't have bees at Prosser. There are so many bees because of the orchards. Mm-hmm. Everyone has bee boxes out there. So we just
have enough.
That's what
benefit.
I'm asking. How do we know they're not zinnia? You don't see the word zinnia honey out there.
That's true. I think you'd have to be a lot of zinnias.
Yeah, we have a lot.
Now, when we talk about, say, wild salmon, for example, and supporting that, it's often counterintuitive to purchase it, but it supports that whole community and economic system around that. Is that the same with bees? Should we all be seeking out
local
honey? Delicious honey in order to support the community?
That would be a huge thing. Additionally, as much as possible, practicing pesticide-free lawn care, garden care, eating practices as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So many pesticides that are used on an agricultural scale are detrimental to bees.
We put zero pesticide in our garden, and we have tons and tons of bees in the summertime. But we have wild arugula we let grow with all the blossoms, and tons of blossoms everywhere so they can be happy. Happy bees.
Happy bees.
They can
happy
be
home.
Happy.
But, the idea of getting a house for them would be a cool idea, actually, coming to think about this. Mm-hmm. It's a good idea.
Maybe we should have honey as one of our things for your dinners, and we can invite Pharrell.
Oh.
So he can be happy.
Be happy? Yeah. Let's do it. Next week.
Is that Pharrell who did Don't Worry? That?
No, that's Bobby
Farron. That's Bobby Farron.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, exactly. Never mind. Forget it. Sean says, wrap it up, buddy. Up next, food for thought, tasty trivia. It's going to be a wild, wild segment. Stay with us. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. Yeah! I have to scold the audience.
Clap harder.
Look, you give them a sandwich and they
better.
Just go away on you. We are ready for our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. It's the weekly show where Tom Douglas wins and you all lose.
In your dreams.
In my dreams.
In
I
your
forgot
dreams.
That part.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm actually going to be your competitor today, Tom and Terry. So Sarah, our production assistant, is going to lead the quiz. Today we are going to play for an audience member that's here live in the audience. She's a regular, actually, so she should probably be getting a punch card at this point for as many times as she's joined us here at the Hot Stove Society. Her name Shelley, and what we do is we're each going to get 5 questions. Whoever gets the most correct wins. Whoever gets the least amount of correct loses and has to give something to Shelley. So, Tier Rotro, what will you give to Shelley?
Brunch for two at Luke, Saturday or Sunday.
Tom?
We'll do brunch. We'll match brunch at
okay.
the Carlisle Room. Saturday and Sunday, we're open for brunch at the Carlisle Room, so we'll do the same thing, brunch for two.
All right. Shelley, I'm going to give away happy hour at Tanaka-san. I was there this weekend. I had a delicious sake slushy, and there was some really fun appetizers on that happy hour menu. So a little gift card for Tanaka-san.
Looks like no matter what, Shelley's a winner already.
Yeah, that's right. She gets a little something special.
All right, I'll start.
All right. This food was considered high status in 18th century America. Was it carrots, celery, radish, or watercress?
Celery.
That's correct.
Oh!
Yeah.
What? I had 4 to pick from.
Nice guess there, Chef.
What?
So, Terry, a white wine noted for aromas of cut grass, fresh green herbs, and asparagus is?
A Sauvignon Blanc.
That's correct. You didn't even need the choices. A varietally correct wine is one that is from a controlled denomination growing area that contains only one grape variety, whose flavor is consistent with the grape variety it is made from, or that does not discriminate against other varieties.
I go with one.
Unfortunately, your guessing didn't work as well that time. It was whose flavor is consistent with the grape variety it is made from. So that is C.
Well, I'm not quite even understanding the whole whole thing here. I thought, okay, never mind.
So I guess it tastes like the grape that it was made from instead of like anything else.
Oh.
So like oak or, yeah.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. No, I get the whole, I just didn't understand the whole
yep.
thing. Never mind.
Okay. How do you know if a brine is salty enough to cure meat or fish? You want some options?
Yes, please.
All right. A, it makes your lips pucker. B, it will draw water from an eggplant. C, an egg will float in it. Or D, it will uncurl a sliver of scallion.
An egg will float in it. And it will
yes.
also do the eggplant thing, too. But an egg will float in it.
All right, Terry, you have 3 out of 4 correct. Let's see if you can make that almost a perfect score. Where would you be served pizza with pickled ginger, minced mutton, and tofu? In France, Japan, Ceylon, or India?
I'm going to go Japan.
It's actually India.
I knew it.
Yeah, we were going to be that.
Oh.
It was confusing because she was nodding to your, to your thoughts on it.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
This year to lead you astray. That is 3 out of 5 for you, Terry. Not a bad showing, though. Not a bad one at all.
Not if you're playing against Tom and Katie. You.
All right, Katie, you go next.
Yeah, Tom likes to pull up the rear. Mm. So. I mean, am I right?
This is a family show?
Am I right?
all right, so Katie, your first question. Mm-hmm. Bringing this as a dinner gift is considered an insult by someone in Portugal, Spain, and Italy. Is it fruit, flowers, candy, or wine?
I like this.
I'm going to say flowers.
It is actually wine.
Wine?
It implies the host can't provide it.
It implies that the host doesn't have a good cello.
Get over yourself, host. Enjoy that wine. Go on.
All right. What percentage of the protein in a hen's egg is in the white? A, the white contains no protein. B, 50%. C, 75%. Or D, 100%. Yolks contain no protein.
I'm going to say 75%.
It's actually 50%.
Oh.
Katie, which peppercorns are not really pepper at all? White, green, pink or red, or black? Pink and red is one.
Pink and red.
That is correct. Pink peppercorns are berries of the Bayous rose plant, or pepper tree, native to South America.
Mm-hmm. Knew that.
Katie, Italians produce a sweet, concentrated dessert wine from a dried grape, and it is called Prosecco, Barolo, Sinar, or Vinsanto?
I'm going to say Vinsanto.
That is correct. All right, Katie, if you get this one correct, you and Terry will be tied.
Okay. Ooh. Give me something good, something easy.
All right. Hops are used in brewing primarily as a source of alcohol from fermentation, flavor, sugars, or resinous oil.
Is it the flavor?
It is the flavor.
Yes.
Yeah, there we go.
Don't
dry hop, fresh hops.
Confuse you.
Yeah.
It's a tie with me, Miss Kiddio.
All right, let's hope that Tom really fails right now.
All right, Tom.
Very sweet.
Okay. All right, Tom, let's see what you can do. To a winemaker, racking a wine means to transfer it to another barrel, store bottles in a rack, age in a cask or barrel, or clarify it by filtering.
Clarify it by filtering.
This says it's to transfer it to another barrel. All right. Professional chefs use this to peel ginger. A European vegetable peeler, a utility knife, an ordinary teaspoon, or a really long fingernail of the thumb?
Teaspoon.
That is correct, yes. All right. Acid-forming foods include eggs, meat, and poultry, fruits and vegetables, grains and legumes, or cheese and milk.
I'll go cheese and milk.
It says eggs, meat, and poultry. Protein-rich foods tend to acidify the body when digested.
That kind of acid.
Okay.
We're learning all types of new things here.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Chayote is a squash native to Mexico. On French menus, it is called a courgette americaine, a Christophen, a poire végétale, or a courgette indienne?
I'll go with the D.
B.
Yes, it was B.
Not D, but B.
They taste bland and are used in many ways, including raw in salads. Okay, your last question, Tom. This product started out as a communion wine substitute. Was
Mogan it? David.
That is... that says it's not correct. Nope. Manischewitz was not a communion wine.
That's what my church always served.
Yeah. All that Manischewitz.
So let's keep going.
It was Dr. Welch's unfermented wine. Welch was a religious teetotaler. So Welch grapefruit, or grape juice.
Well, exactly what I said.
Yeah,
of course. Have you ever had Mogan David's or Manischewitz? It tastes just like Welch's grape juice.
That is true. All right, Tom. Well, with that, you are indeed
the loser. What do you mean, all
loser.
Right? You gave me an X.
You were the loser.
Okay, Shelley, you're having brunch at the Carlisle Room. Thank you so much.
Good job.
If you want to be part of the show, you can join us on Facebook or Twitter, Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio. This show is produced by Tina Noah, Large Media, although today Sarah Leibovitz did a beautiful job of being our producer. Sean, Don't Call Me Del Torre is our engineer.
Make the phone work
part
today,
of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy a ticket for only $15. And remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.